Hi, this is Barry, and welcome to the next edition of Simplicity Zen. If you're watching this on YouTube, if you could take a moment and hit like and subscribe, and that helps feed information into the algorithm that pushes this to more people. So that'd be appreciative. Also, if you have anything you'd like to comment for it, good or bad, feel free to do that. If you're watching or listening on the podcast networks, you can rate the podcast or the audio or the episodes on the networks. And you can also go to simplicityzen.com and sign up there. So today we're going to do something a little bit different. One of my teachers at my local Sangha, Soan Jim Hare, welcome, Jim. He had the idea of actually interviewing me for this podcast. And so here we are. And so I'll pretty much hand it over to you, Jim.
All right, Gary, Barry, thank you. Well, I just had this idea. I thought that you started this and it's been appreciated by a lot of people. And I thought turnaround is fair play and it'd be good for your audience to hear about your engagement with Zen over the years. So it was my idea. I take full responsibility for this and let's get started. So our guest today is Barry Crawford, and this is his bio as it appears on the ClearMind website. Barry started practicing Zen meditation in 1992. He lived at the Sonoma Mountain Zen Center and practiced as a resident there in the mid-90s. He then, after leaving Sonoma Mountain, he practiced with Diane Rizzetto in the Ordinary Mind Zen School. I believe at that time they were in Richmond.
Oakland.
Oakland, yeah. Okay.
Well, the Piedmont area of Oakland.
Okay, area of Oakland. And then later, Barry became a student of John Shoji Sorensen. And in 2022, well, he was ordained by John, and in 2022, was authorized to independently teach, and he currently engages with a teacher, Kyofu Seikyo, Russell Mitchell, in the White Plum Sangha, Koan study tradition. And he's been now authorized as an assistant Koan teacher by Kyofu Seikyo. Barry serves in the Doan Ryo at Valley Stream Zen Sangha in Sacramento and is a member of the board of directors of the Sacramento Dharma Center. So Barry, let's get started. And okay. I think you start a lot of your interviews asking people about a little bit about their family background growing up, where they grew up, kind of what the structure of the family was. And I'm particularly interested in knowing where you stand in the birth order of your family, because I think that has quite a bit of influence on mm-hmm. people. And any experiences that you'd like to relate, from your growing up years that you think might be influential on your eventual engagement with the Zen path.
Yeah. Turnabout's fair play. So, yeah. So I was born in Utah, Logan, Utah. It's like a college town in Utah. I imagine lots of Mormons, though we weren't Mormon. My dad was a philosophy professor, and philosophy professors pretty much go where the jobs are. I don't think they get, it's not a lot of picking and choosing. If something opens up, they jump on it. We lived in a kind of outside of town, pretty rural area. I think I lived there until I was four-ish, so I don't have tons of memories. The probably relevant to my later life, my mom's a stay-at-home mom. I was the firstborn. Probably for the first four of my years of my life, it was just me at home with my parents. There's no preschool or no daycare or anything like that. And so, I think I was pretty comfortable being by myself at a really young age. I'm not, I like people, like engaging with them, but, I think I could safely say I'm an introvert, and probably a lot of that just happens. And it's not like I don't like being around a lot of people. I mean, sometimes it's exhausting, but it's more like I just, you know, the first 4 years of my life, I was just basically hanging out with me, my mom, and sometimes my dad. So I just was comfortable just not, you know, having a huge dynamic. Probably also resulted in me, you know, being a little weird. I don't know, like, you know, I don't fit into molds that well. I'm 4 years older than my brother and 5 years older than my sister, something like that. Yeah, I don't really remember my brother being born, but I remember my sister being born. Then my dad got a job in the White House working for Jimmy Carter. So we moved to Maryland area. And that was pretty cool. Like, we lived in Silver Spring. I think we lived briefly in DC, and then they bought a house in Silver Spring, and all around me was woods. And, you know, I just spent all my days out playing in the woods.
Wait, let me interrupt you there. Jimmy Carter needed a philosophy professor.
He needed someone. Yeah. My dad somehow. Yeah. No. Yeah. His job there was working. I think he had two jobs. One is he helped develop, policies or, you know, policies for, rural America, you know, just like what are the goals of the administration for rural America. That was one of his jobs, was just working on policy. And the second was he was the liaison for governors to contact the White House.
So he was on the White House staff then.
Yeah, you know, and I remember, you know, as a kid, you know, so if you've never been to the White House, there's the White House, which is broken up into two parts. There's the business part, you know, I think it's the executive wing, and then there's the East Wing, or, you know, then there's like the house, the president's home. And then within the same grounds, you know, with really, at least at that time, with no gates between them, there's the old executive building, which is this big concrete kind of spooky looking building. And that's where my dad worked. But, you know, like, we could, like, whenever the president would come or leave, you know, anyone who wanted to could go out and sit on the lawn and, like, shake his hand as he got off and on the helicopter. So we did that a couple times. And my dad's a, you know, crazy workaholic. And so he'd often go in on the weekends, and I would go with him and just, you know, just do weird creative things. You know, I'd basically all the papers and pencils and tape that the federal government could afford, you know, so I'd build giant stuff, you know. And I remember one time I actually went exploring, and I left the old executive office building, crossed the road, you know, the little parking lot there, went into the executive wing of the White House, the West Wing, I guess it's called. And I think I made it a good, like, 3 or 4 minutes down it before someone's like, who are you? You know, you know, and kicked me out. But, you know, I mean, I imagine in the post 9/11 world, things are,
yeah,
you know, like, you know, now you can't even really get up to the gates that well. There's like barriers and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was pretty chill. You know, my dad would just flash his badge to go in, you know. You know, the gate. There, you know, it was just some guy reading a newspaper, like, oh yeah, going in, you know. But yeah, so that was cool. And then he worked for Amtrak, and, you know, so he worked at you know, just like kind of business development at Amtrak, and so we got to ride everywhere for free. That was cool. And then things are, you know, I think I was pretty happy as a kid. I think things got tough in junior high. Those were probably like the two worst years of my life. Like, part of it was I had a falling out with one of my friends in the summer between sixth and seventh grade. And so me and that friend group, we just kind of went separate ways. And so I started seventh grade with, like, basically no friend groups. And so, you know, that was a really rough transition. Got bullied a little bit. But I think within 2 months or 3 months, I found another friend group and things got better. But, you know, that, I just remember that being pretty scary. And I think that made me probably like pretty sensitive to not being accepted by groups. You know, that was like a very deeply ingrained lesson, you know, in my in my subconscious, like, you know, be very cautious so you're not ostracized, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, which to this day is still there. I don't really believe those thoughts, you know, they don't really affect my life anymore. But like, those neural pathways will clearly always be there to some degree, you know. And you know, I'm into the neuroscience stuff. And the neuroscience behind that is like old neuro pathways never get erased, just new ones get created that get stronger, you know. But those old ones are always there and can get refired in the right circumstances. Yeah, and then, you know, high school, we moved to California. My dad got another job. And that was a huge culture shock. Because, you know, in Maryland, you know, it rains all year long. So everything's wet and, or, you know, green and lush. And, you know, just felt like a sense of solidity there. But to go to Southern California where everything's either desert or manicured, like it just, like everything seemed fake. Like the people, the landscaping, it was, I was very, it was not a good, I mean, it was a, I wasn't like miserable, but it was, I didn't like it. I didn't want to be there. And, but I've like the people that I kind of, liked, you know, felt at home with were like, kind of like the skateboarder pot smoker types, you know, and, you know, we would skip school and, you know, and go skateboard and, you know, we weren't really causing trouble. Just, I just was totally unengaged with school. And then one day they called me into the counselor's office. She's like, "Hey, Barry, you know, we seems like you're not totally, you know, getting along at this school. You know, it's not, you know, we could take you to this like wonderful school. You know, it's unstructured. It's meant for like creative types, and you know, and I think it'll be really good for you." I'm like, "Oh, that sounds great," you know. And so they sent me to that. It ended up being like a continuation school, you know, for a bunch of like people that the government legally has to keep in school for 4 years, but they've given up any hope of educating, you know? And so like, and like the first day I walked into the principal's office, he took one look at me. He says, "You don't belong here." I was like, "Oh God, what is this?" But I ended up being like the expeditionary force of a bunch of deadheads to follow in there, you know? Like a lot of my friends ended up following me in. So, you know, so I mean, I literally through all those years didn't do any schoolwork, none, like literally none. I think I wrote one essay or something, maybe. I think we just chilled, you know, like our science class was raking leaves, you know. And you know, I ended up just eventually, and then my friend, I think, you know, and then I, you know, and then we discovered the Grateful Dead, and so you know, we got really into that. You know, which kind of plays into my story, how I got into practice. And, you know, yeah, at some point I just took my GED. I didn't do that. I just barely passed on the math. But the, like the English part, I actually got like 95 percentile or something. Because I read a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. So I was like accidentally educated just by reading.
And your parents weren't alarmed that you were sent to a continuation high school? Weren't they that interventionist?
Well, I don't know if they played any part in it. I don't remember them, maybe behind the scenes they did, but I think it was more like, "Hey, they're sending me to this art school or something." And they're like, "Oh, okay, you know."
I guess they had other things to think about.
Or they were lied to by the high school as well. I don't know. You know, that's a good question. I've never asked them about that. Yeah. And so then I, you know, discovering the Grateful Dead and having a few kind of key psychedelic experiences just completely changed my trajectory of my life. You know, I, you know, kind of being, you know, just kind of like spiritual aspiration became like really the only thing I cared about, you know, that was probably even like in 11th grade. And, like, I mean, do you want me to talk about the whole Grateful Dead unfolding thing or?
Oh, as it relates to, you know, your entry into the Zen path, I think it would be, we know some other Zen luminaries who have followed that same path. So to that extent, yes, please.
Yeah. So in 10th grade, I lived for a couple months in Sun Valley, Idaho, where my grandma lived, which is kind of like a nice ski resort in Idaho. And I had, you know, I'd fallen into a, you know, a bad crowd there as well. And one night we all took LSD and just, it was just basically a, you know, interestingly, I, you know, even though I, hallucinogenics are really into my, were really important to me. And, you know, I went through, like most high school and college kids, I did a little drinking. I never was like a hardcore partier in a lot of ways. Like it was always more like, I was always interested in just exploring, you know, the contours of human consciousness. Like that was always my goal. Like I was, even though I'd go to parties and I'd drink and maybe someone passed me a joint or something, I was never chasing pleasure. You know what I mean? I was more like, it was always like a consciousness exploration thing for me, you know, mostly at least. Well, anyway, but you know, so that night, you know, we did that. We're just walking around. So the next morning came and, I don't know if I should tell the story, but I'll tell it. So I was still flying, you know, and I was laying on my bed and I was like laying on my dog's tummy. And she had recently had her uterus removed or something, you know, whatever they do to dogs to make them not have babies.
Neuter them, yeah.
And I had this like hallucination of like a doctor reaching in her stomach and like taking out like a baby puppy, like a fetus puppy. And then all of a sudden my dog jumped up and like snarled at me and bared her teeth. And I'm like, oh, like that was pretty weird. And then like, then my grandma walks in the room and she's like, what's going on? And I'm like, my dog's name is Amanita. I'm like, Amanita freaked out on me. And she's like, oh, by the way, we're going cross country skiing, get ready. And I'm like, oh God, like I'd forgotten I agreed to go cross country skiing with my grandma.
Wait a minute. The dog's name was Amanita.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, yeah, if you're wondering, I named it. But like for me, like music was always huge in my life. You know, I would listen. I'd just lay around for hours listening to music. I mean, it was always, you know, super. You know, you know. At first, I was into like I remember the first band I was or artist I was really into was Prince. Then I discovered the Talking Heads, and then I discovered like I guess what we call classic rock, like the Doors and Led Zeppelin, and I also was into the Grateful Dead, but they were just one of many bands that I liked. You know, I liked Led Zeppelin, I liked the Doors, I liked Pink Floyd, I liked the Grateful Dead. Like I just loved that genre of music, but like the Grateful Dead weren't my favorite. They were just one of many classic rock bands I was into. But that day, you know, so we went up to this a really picturesque. Cross country skiing lodge, and I remember we walk into the the dining room area, like the main lodge, and there was music playing, but it didn't really capture my attention. And then we went down a hallway, and I remember this very clearly, and we go into the rental shop to get our skis, and there's this little radio or a little tape player or something like sitting on a shelf kind of like right at my height of my head, and I walk by it and it just stopped me in my tracks. Like this music was like completely it sounded like ancient and like fragile and just like, I mean, it was like emanating like this like fundamental, like I can't even explain it, but it just stopped me in my tracks. And I was just like, what is this? You know? And it like it sounded like it was reminding me something that I forgot or something like that, you know? And I'm like, is this music? And like the hippie working there, you know, he's like waxing, he's like, oh, it's Jerry Garcia band, you know. I was like, oh my God, you know. And at that point I knew I had to go see the Grateful Dead live, because like that was and in a lot of ways that was like the way you could say is the first spiritual experience I'd ever had in my life. You know, I grew up completely atheist. Like I think I literally never had a conversation about religion with my parents. I mean, I think to this day, other than them asking me about Zen, like we did go to church. It just wasn't talked about. I was, extremely materialist, you know, I just assumed, like, of course there's no God. I mean, it's not even open for debate, you know? And I actually got kicked out of the Cub Scouts in a gifted kids program in elementary school because I told them I didn't believe in God. And they're like, "Oh, you're out."
Oh, wow.
And, well, anyway, but so this was my first inkling that there was, like, something, you know, and then plus the whole dog reading my mind, you know, like, it's like something's weird is going on here, you know? And so then, so I moved back to California after the ski season and I got to see my first live show and, you know, I took Lucid Jinx, but like the first four times I saw them, like, it didn't grab me, you know, I barely even remember the concerts actually, you know, but I didn't like that like ancient, you know, mesmerizing magic that I heard on that tape. Like, I wasn't getting that at the live concert for whatever reason. But there's one time, I think the fourth or fifth show I saw. Yeah, but even though I wasn't totally, I mean, the scene was just amazing. You know, it was just like, I mean, it was just such a, like, I don't even know how to articulate it. It was just, everyone was free and it was just, you know, and I was starting to really, like, question the values of Western civilization and materialism and just working to make money and like just the Grateful Dead just seemed to be a scene that really valued those same values. So I was like really drawn just by the people and the scene and just the craziness and immensity of it. And so I kept going even though I wasn't like totally, you know, awakened to the music yet. But so it was like my fourth or fifth show and it was in December 1989, and I was sitting in the Forum, and I was sitting before the show, and I was like staring at the stage. You know, people are kind of filing in, and there was something about the stage like just totally, completely captured my attention. It was just so compelling. I just like it was just like it was so there, like nothing had ever been there before. And this, and like it was like emanating this energy, and it was getting more intense and more intense and more intense. And then like it reached a crescendo, and then like the lights went out and the band took the stage, and like the way they played, like I finally got it, you know, like that magic I'd heard on the tape, I'd finally started experiencing in real time. And it, I mean, just completely blew my mind, you know, and it's, you know, it's ineffable, you know, it's impossible to talk about. You can kind of talk about, you know, your emotional experience of it, but you can't talk like what it was. All you can call it is like it, you know, it's just, it's like a, you can sense it, you know, cause it's real. So it's going through somehow going through your senses, but it's like every other sense. There's not like a label you can put on it. You know what I mean? Like, and it's not something you can't describe it. You can't, you know what I mean? It's just, so it's there, you're sensing it, but it's completely ineffable. Like it doesn't, you know, flow through, you know, the Samja Vedana pathways, whatever those are. You know, it's like it's completely a different type of experience.
Maybe a little like Zazen.
Yes, some of my Zazen is not all of it. Sometimes I'm just there with achy knees, but like, but yeah, but certainly, you know, I mean, I Zen ended up being the thing that made me realize. But anyway, and so I kept going to shows and it kept escalating and escalating. And, you know, and I, you know, it just, you know, just, I don't know how to really fully explain it. I mean, I'm still haven't really come to grips. It was because there was really only like a 2.5 year period where I was going to a lot of shows and kind of getting into that zone. But like, I still can't fully explain what the hell that was. You know, how's this like old fat guy on stage playing music that is opening everyone's hearts in an incredibly spiritual, mystical way? It doesn't make sense to me, you know, but like, cause I've seen like, you know, and I remember the first time I saw I'd seen the Grateful Dead maybe 10 times before I saw another band. I went and saw Clapton and I just thought all concerts were maybe like that. And like, I'm like, what? This kind of sucks, you know? You know, like there's something very special about the Grateful Dead. And like, and at that point, I got to understand what's going on. Cause like, one thing those experience, I mean, what was compelling about those experiences were three things. One of them was a distinct sense of oneness, right? Not oneness in the sense that like I'm you and you are me. Like that still kind of has a duality built into it, right? It was like everything is one. There's only the one, you know? It's not like there's lots of things that are connected. Everything is one thing, you know? Like that was a very clear perceptual thing I had. Like I remember one time we were all dosed at my friend's house, and the Grateful Dead released a new kind of contemporary live recordings, and there's a song called China Cat, and one of the lines is called, you know, the lyrics are a one-eyed Cheshire. I can't even think of the whole lyrics, but anyway, there's that line, there's a one-eyed Cheshire, and when Jerry said one, or saying one, like I just blew open, you know, like one, of course it's all one, you know, and I couldn't believe it. And like when he would say it, like reality would just ripple open, you know, just, and like, and I kept rewinding it and listening to that like 20 times. And one time my friend walked over, was like, what are you doing? I'm like, don't you hear it? He's like, no. And so that was one thing that became clear. And then the other thing that came clear was, it was like, this was actual reality. And I'd left it and I needed to go back to it. Like it was like a very clear, like it was just true, you know, like that is my heart. I've left it. It's there, but I've lost it. And now I need to go back to it. So that was another thing that became clear just experientially. I've never read a spiritual book or anything. Mm-hmm. And the third was that, you know, in that space is like complete peace and healing, you know? And so like with those three things, I was like, this is what I'm doing. My whole life is, I didn't care about a career. I didn't care about anything. I just wanted to go further down that path. And, but I went to college, you know, just cause that's what upper middle class white kids do, you know? And first I was an art major and then religious studies and then psychology, but all towards that, you know what I mean? Hmm. Like I thought, like, I'll just make my money being a rafting guide because I raft guided in the summer. I'll be a raft guide in the summer and ski patrol in the winter and meditate the rest of the time, you know. But, you know, and so I started looking at another thing that became clear is was these Grateful Dead experiences were just hints at possibilities. Like it wasn't going to get me there, you know. And so I quickly, you know, stopped, you know, taking chemicals and stuff. And I just, and I knew that, you know, I needed to find some sort of tradition. And so at first I looked into shamanism because that was big during the days, but that didn't quite, you know, it was all about spirits and journeying. There really wasn't much about that, like that ground I discovered, like, you know, that, you know, like fundamental oneness of the universe, you know? But then I read the book, you know, I know a lot of people in our lineage don't love it, but Three Pillars of Zen. And I read those, the Enlightenment chapter, and I'm like, that is what, you know, the Grateful Dead experiences were like. And so I'm like, it's all about Zen, you know. Mm-hmm. And then you know, I tried meditating by myself a little bit, but that didn't really work. But then in my first year of college, I went to Humboldt. I lived up in Humboldt or in Arcata. It's like kind of a half old conservative loggers and then half like hippies, at least back then. But so I was walking to the co-op and there was on their billboard was, you know, one day Zen sitting. And I went to that and Mae Lee Scott had come up from Berkeley Zen Center. Did you ever meet Mae Lee?
I never did. No.
Yeah. Yeah. So she was the first Zen priest I ever met. So I did a one day sesshin a half day sitting. And, you know, I'm like, you know, I didn't have any mind blowing experiences, but it felt right. Like this is the path. Like I just knew Zen was it for me, you know, just no question. Like I didn't know anything about Buddhism at all, except there's these feelings of oneness, getting back to something you've lost. And, you know, and within it's like complete, you know, resolution, you know. I knew that, and I knew people who sat a lot in Zazen had that same thing. So that was the full extent of my knowledge of Buddhism, you know? Mm-hmm. And so with that, I'm like, oh, yeah, this is definitely it. So like in Three Pillars of Zen, they go to a lot of sesshins and then they have Kensho and then everything's great. So I thought, well, I just need to go to a sesshin. And so I'm like, well, so what are the Zen centers around here? And the closest like real Zen center was Green Gulch. And so I called them and I said, you know, can I come down and do a sesshin? And they're like, sure, it's $600. And I'm like, well, I don't have any money. And they're like, have you sat before? And I'm like, yeah, I've sat, you know, because I'd done the half day sitting. And and they're like, well, we, you know, and so we worked out a deal where I would, I'd miss one of the sittings and do dishes. And that was pay for my sesshin. And as it turned out, Green Gulch, their Zendo was being fixed or something. And so they actually held it at City Center.
No.
And there was like my monk, I had a handler. I don't know if he was Tonto or head of sesshin or whatever. But he was my handler. And I always thought like, I wonder what happened to that guy. And then years later, I think it dawned on me on a Dokusan with Myo Leahy, which is your teacher, one of your teachers. I'm like, oh, that was Myo. And then I told him about it. He's like, yeah, that sounds right. You know, because I'd always wondered like, what happened to that monk? Did he give up? Did he go all the way? You know? But yeah, that I could tell within maybe two sitting periods, I'd made an enormous mistake. You know, like I just, any thought of enlightenment or even sitting in regular Zazen posture was out the door immediately. It just completely became it was just a question of survival, you know?
Right.
And, yeah, you know, it was a 7-day sesshin. And like, I mean, that 7 days, like, how long it felt probably feels about how one of my years feel now, you know?
Right.
And like, it was just so incredibly difficult, but, and I was also really surprised at how much ritual was in Zen. Cause you know, they don't talk about that in the books.
Right.
But you know, but the Soto Zen liturgy, I imprinted on it, you know? And even though I've worked in other lineages, it's still the Soto Zen forms and liturgy is kind of my DNA for like forms, you know. And plus, I lived at Sonoma Zen Center, but even just from that one sesshin, like it just like I was like a mother duck. It was the first duck I saw, and so you know that's my mother. And that's you know a lot of reason why I like to do on Rio because like it's become such a part of my DNA. But yeah, And then like my roommate there, he's like, how are you getting home? I'm like, I don't know. I think I'm going to hitchhike. He's like, oh, you can't hitchhike. And so he gave me money for the bus. But I was like so spun after the sesshin somehow money and lost my bag. And then so I had to hitchhike home. And then like the CHP said, I can't hitchhike on the freeway. And so I had to stay for like a day on an off ramp. And finally this hippie picked me up and took me to Humboldt. But, you know, and then it was like, and then like my goal was like immediately was like to move to a monastery. But then I accidentally fell into a relationship. And so that lasted a couple of years. Mm. And that kind of kept me in civilization, broke up. I was going to move to Green Gulch, but I went and visited Sonoma Mountain Zen Center. And I just loved the isolation of it, the Zendo. Powerful, you know, and the teacher seemed fine. You know, I wasn't looking for a teacher. I just wanted to play, you know, I thought you do a lot of Zazen and you have enlightenment. And so all I cared about was a place to do well. Oh, that was the big thing is their schedule had like twice the Zazen that Green Gulch did. Mm-hmm. So I didn't. So other than just calling to see if it was an option, like I never really looked, I never like followed up Green Gulch. I'm like, it's going to be Sonoma Mountain. So I went and I met with them and they let me, so I signed up for a year. Yeah, it was crazy, you know, it's like living at a monastery and, you know, just, I mean, it, like the practice periods were so intense, like when sesshin would start, I wouldn't even hardly notice, you know, it was just a little incremental increase in in the city, you know. And right. It was weird though, because like I right when I showed, the teacher Kwang Roshi came down with something. Someone once told me later what it was. They figured out what it was. I can't remember now. But he was really sick and basically bedridden. And so we didn't have a teacher. There was just like maybe 10 of us living there. And I'm just totally following the Soto forms. I was the assistant gardener. And I used to fight with the main gardener about killing gophers because I was a hardcore vegan, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, and so in it, and I can't remember if I did one or two practice. I think I did a whole practice period and then most of another one or something. But like the hardest part about it was, and I think especially with no like leadership really, other than like the senior students, was the interpersonal conflict was just insane. And it wasn't a lot of fighting; it was just tension among people, you know. And like not everyone who gives up their life and goes to a Zen is always in the best mental space. And like, it just, everyone, like there's some people just grating on me. Some people I loved terribly, you know, but it was like, you know, it, like just feeling a little drift without a teacher and just like feeling like the community wasn't healthy. I thought I've got to leave. And so I thought like, I got to go tell, you know, the director, I'm going to leave. And I thought like, oh God, they're going to try to talk me out of it. And there's going to be all these meetings. Cause they were all very, you know, let's talk about this and kumbaya. And, you know, like, I'm like, I don't want to. So I called my friend. I'm like, come pick me up in the middle of the night. And so I just left and I left a note on my bed and saying, and explaining, you know, I know it's right for me to leave. I know it's kind of lame that I just left, but I didn't want to be talked out of it. I'm sorry, you know. And I ended up, they had all ended up writing me letters later saying, you know, we understand, you're always welcome back, you know. Hmm. But
well, that interpersonal conflict that you talk about and the tension, I think is one reason why at Zen Center they didn't used to in the early days, they didn't used to start the service with all my ancient twisted karma from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, I now fully avow. But every now, you know, I think because of that aspect of the that, you know, just people rubbing shoulders, the same people rubbing shoulders every day, that it becomes necessary to really understand the difficulty of that, and mm-hmm. And yeah, confess our complicity in creating that difficulty. So yeah, mm-hmm. I think in the early days we didn't recognize that as yeah. well as we do now.
That's a great point. And looking back, that was a really important teaching for me. Yeah. I've heard the analogy of like sharp rocks rubbing against each other and becoming polished.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I think there is an aspect of that.
Right.
Yeah. Another thing I got out of it, you know, other than, you know, they were very traditional in the Soto forms there. So, you know, I'd still deepen my love of the Soto liturgy and forms. And you know, it was a lot of sitting. You know, I think even during the in between the practice periods, I think there was four sittings a day. That was like the baseline, you know.
It was the interim was like schedule, huh?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, so I got pretty good at sitting in the sense, by good, I mean that I developed the capacity to kind of sink into samadhi, you know, or samadhi to overcome me. You know, it's not like something you can invoke. It's something that kind of comes to you or doesn't.
Your body like, got accustomed to it. I mean, your body, right?
Yeah. My body learned how to go into samadhi. It wasn't like a will into, you know, and to this day I can pretty easily get back to that, you know, like if I get like during the summers, I don't sit a lot because of all the rafting and I'll notice the samadhi drifts away. But when I get back into a tougher schedule or deeper schedule, I get back into that really a lot easier than if I'd never done that. So while I'm a huge proponent of lay Zen and I think it's a valid complete path in and of itself, I definitely value that deep residential practice I did And I know in retrospect, it wasn't that much, but at the time I was young. So it was a huge, it felt like a huge chunk of my life, you know? Mm-hmm. And, so I think, you know, any young person who has the opportunity to take a year or two off and go do that, I definitely think it's worth it. You know? Yeah. So I decided to go back to college. I learned to program because I wanted to make games, like computer games. Hmm. And for fun, like not even for work, just for fun. This is before I left for the monastery. And so I got out of college. I'm like, well, what am I going to do now? I'm like, well, I know how to program. And I just have a real natural aptitude for it. And so I'm like, well, I guess I'll get a computer science degree. And at that point, my dad had moved to North Carolina to be a professor at another university. And I could go there for free. So I moved out there to go there. And there's no local Zen center. And so my city was pretty sporadic for, you know, a year or two. But then I started working and I moved back to the Bay Area and there was Zen Center. So I started, you know, getting really heavily into Zen again. And that's when I met Diane Rossetto. And, you know, she was just such a wonderful teacher. I mean, it's exactly what I needed at the time. She's one of those people in Dokusan, you know, you just look in their eyes and there's just like infinity there. You know what I mean? Like it was just, like it wasn't so much her teachings, which were, you know, pretty classic, you know, Joko Beck style Zen, I think, at least at the time. Mm-hmm. But it was just like, it just our energy, like I think awakening is a little bit, contagious, you know, and I just like, just being in her presence and practicing with her, it kind of woke up something in me, which I'm not sure whatever would happen if I had never met her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then I had, you know, I guess what you could call a pretty deep spiritual experience during that time. This was during the .com era. So I made a lot of money just being a consultant. And I was so burned out and I had had my own company for a little while. I was so burned out. I'm like, I'm going to take a year off and I'm just going to scuba dive and go to Sesshin. So I'd go to like Hawaiian scuba dive and then I would come back and I'd go to a week long Sesshin, you know, or I'd go camp, you know, I was like sitting a lot for about a year and a half. And, you know, something kind of opened up for me there. And it was, you know, pretty incredible, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, even more life-changing than the Grateful Dead, but it wore off and I was deeply disappointed in that. And because I felt like I was kind of ripped out of heaven in a lot of ways, you know, and then I met my wife and I moved to Sacramento to.
I have a question before you say you said you were ripped out of what you were that it didn't last or something. I mean, you mean the Grateful Dead experience or
no, the, you know, the kind of the opening. Cause at its peak, you know, cause like, you know, when things opened up, a couple things were clear, you know, the oneness was complete, you know, it wasn't even oneness. It was just nothing, you know? Hmm. And, but you know, when, things, the universe kind of reassembled itself and I could start thinking, like it became clear to me, like, oh, there's no such thing as a problem. There's the opposites are just an illusion. You know, of course there's not a problem. You know, this is reality. It's like, obviously this is the way to live, you know? And then, you know, later as my dualistic brain started kind of clinking back into place, you know, this was on the way to work after a Sesshin actually. And I remember sitting in the parking lot thinking like, oh, okay. So I'm an enlightened Buddha. Cool. like, all right. You know, it's real. You know, the ancients weren't lying to us. Like, sweet, you know, you know, it didn't dawn on me that I could have any other way of looking at reality. And I remember I got to work and at one point there was just a crowd of people gathered around my cube, just whatever energy I was giving off, they loved it, you know, and just everybody was like, just like literally there's like a crowd of people just standing around my cube, like staring at me while I was smiling, you know, like, nice. And one of my friends is like, what happened to you? Did you get laid? You know, you seem totally different, you know? And I'm like, I don't know. You know? And I just spent the day at like, I just wanted everything clean. So I just cleaned my cube. And I think I cleaned the board, you know, the meeting room. You know, I just felt so pure. I wanted everything else to be pure. But what started happening was, you know, I don't know if it was days or weeks later, but I noticed like my conditioning was still there. And that's what I felt disappointed in. You know, like I thought that was wiped away.
Oh, that was gone. Yeah.
Yeah. But when I realized that was still there, that's when I'm like, God damn it. You know? Yeah. And then right around that time I met who became my wife, and we got serious pretty quickly. So I moved to Sacramento to live with her. And my intention was to keep, like, I was on the board at the Bay Zen Center, and my intention was to keep practicing with Diane, but it just, you know, when it went away, I started thinking like, oh, maybe enlightenment's a bunch of bullshit. You know, people have these experiences and they fool themselves into saying it's permanent, you know. I mean, because there definitely things changed, but I was so caught on there still being the conditioning. That's, I couldn't let go of that, you know. And so I just kind of faded away from Diane in that practice. I went and checked out you guys, but I hate to say it, but I went, I'm like, oh, there's no teacher. Like, there was no, like, I'm like, who has the brown bib? Like, oh, there's no teacher here. It's just a sitting group. Hmm. You know, I really wish I'd stuck with it, but I didn't. And then Kim got pregnant. And so for those couple of years of where we had babies and toddlers, it was, I won't say I stopped practicing, because like once you've kind of seen, once you've seen reality isn't real, like you can't unsee that, you know. But like I stopped sitting every day. And part of it was like having two young kids like pretty close to each other. They were born 2 years apart. And our first baby was pretty hard. The toddler was pretty hard. It's, you know, it's basically like two full-time jobs just taking care of them. And I just couldn't, every time I would leave, I would make her life worse. So I couldn't go to retreats. And, you know, I think I would pop into Zen centers every once in a while. You know, I went to a one day sitting at Green Gulch, and I came back and I could just tell how hard it was for her, you know? And so it really wasn't until my kids were like 4 and 6, or maybe 5 and 3 or something like that, I started going. And that's when I started sitting at, you know, Valley Streams again. And then I'm just kind of monologuing. Do you have any questions or?
I occasionally am jumping in, but you're doing a good job of answering all the questions I might have asked.
Yeah,
I can tell you a question I have. If you
okay.
So, because you're kind of getting up to the current moment. Mm-hmm. Maybe you want to say something about meeting John Sorensen and you know, ordaining. But, yeah. You know, one of the things I was going to ask about is, you know, you started out, you know, practicing at Sonoma Mountain Zen Center, and then you went over to, you know, the Ordinary Mind group with Joko Beck, and I know now, and then you've been with Valley Streams, but now you're, you know, doing this White Plum Sangha Koan tradition. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering what you, you know, what you think about lineage, what you, you know, think about, you know, continuity, or whether you find that necessary.
It's a good question. And, you know, and people have said, you know, like, why do you have so many fingers and so many pies? And I think there's good parts and bad parts of it. I think it would have been really bad if at the beginning I was in a lot of different groups. I think it was pretty good that I kind of had a, because even the Joko Beck style is pretty, you know, it's informal in the fact that, you know, people don't wear robes and stuff like that, but it's pretty hardcore Dogen style Zen, you know, you know, and it's, you know, it's all about just surrendering completely, you know. And so I've been a good, you know, I mean, how long, I mean, at least 10 or 15 years of my practice was, the first 10 or 15 years was pretty traditional, you know, classical Soto. You know, and so like I think that was good. I think if I had looked around a lot early on, I think that would have stymied me for sure. I wouldn't recommend it. Mm-hmm. But later on, I feel like, so lots of different groups. I don't think there's any Zen lineage Zen lineage that kind of, how can I say this? I think I'm a better practitioner, and I think I'm better able to share the Dharma having seen different experienced different modalities, you know, because I think different things to different people, different approaches are appropriate for different people. And so, I've even done some sessions at like hardcore Rinzai places. And so even if I can't say, like, I know it's there, I know what the energy is like, I know what the practice is like, and I meet someone, I could say, like, I feel like I'm pretty well positioned to be like, you know what, you should go to a Rinzai place. You know, I feel like that's a big advantage. And also, I'm not really, I'm not a very, except with San Francisco Giants and baseball, I'm not a very, like, tribal person. You know, I'm not one of those people who thinks, like, this is the best way and all the other ways are wrong. You know, like, I don't have very much of that DNA. You know, I love diversity. I value different expressions, maybe to a fault, you know, and so it's for me, you know, sitting with you guys and then doing that, like, I don't see any contradiction because I just see it's just more wonderful manifestations of the Dharma. And even the Buddha, you know, there's a sutra, you know, where he basically says there's like four distinct paths and they all have value. You know, it's like even the Buddha, that's a conversation in of itself. But also I'd say, like, through all of this, what I do on the cushion really hasn't changed. You know, like, my muscle memory for Shikantaza is so strong. I sit down and I just sit, you know. You know,
that's maybe, that's what I was going to ask you, yeah. what your zazen is.
It's just Shikantaza. Okay, like, I if I'm not doing a lot of retreats and my, like, samadhi is not quite as strong, like, I'll do one on the out breath. I'll say the word, or now, actually, yeah, I say now is what I'll say now, but I'll breathe that now with my whole body, and it's like, it's not a, you know, a tightening, it's an opening, you know. And so, but with that exception, it's mostly just Shikantaza. Like, you know, as I'm working through as I'm exploring koans, like, I'm not sitting there. Well, there were some exceptions. Like, I sat with Mu for a little while. And then there's another koan, like, what is Mu? No, what's the source of Mu? And that one I sat with for like 2 weeks because I really struggled with that one. So that was a classical, koan experience. But other than that, I don't contemplate my koans during zazen at all. Hmm. And so, like, the way I see koans is a lot the way I see, you know, doing service. It's just chanting sutras. It's just something that kind of stirs the water that helps zazen, or, you know, just awakening in general, you know. And there's no dichotomy in my mind whatsoever with the different practices. Did I answer your question on that?
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, so how I met John. So I kind of, like, had some romantic idea. Like, when I moved to Sonoma Zen Center, I moved there with the intention of being a practitioner, like a residential practitioner the rest of my life, you know. Like, that is why I moved there, you know. So I kind of saw myself being a monk in the sense of, like, just complete dedication to practice. But I never saw myself being a priest or anything like that, you know. But my practice was very, you know, just, I want to wake up type of, that was my motivation. But I had a very weird experience, and I don't know if you remember this because I kind of talked to you about it at the time. But at one point, when my work got crazier, we needed a nanny for about 6 months. And so we hired this young woman to basically be a full-time nanny. She didn't live there, but, you know, she was there from, you know, morning to dinner type of thing. And and then she went off to move to Hawaii in college or whatever it was she was doing. And we stayed Facebook friends, but we didn't have that much contact. But she reached out to me on Facebook and said, hey, would you you willing to, well, I think she said first, will you marry me? And I was like, what? And then I realized like, oh, she's asking me to officiate her wedding. I said, sure, you know. And and I said, okay, I'll look into what I have to do. And there seemed to be two options. One was, oh, and I asked her like, why me? And then she said, well, I don't have a great relationship with my father. So, you know, you like at a time in my life, you were kind of like a male role model that really I needed, you know? And so it just feels right to have you as part of my wedding somehow. I'm like, oh, okay. That's all. You know, I'm honored. Thank you. And so I researched and there were two options. One, I could become like a temporary deputy. I'm not sure if that's exactly the right phrase, at least in here in California. And the other one was to be ordained. And I'm like, well, that being ordained sounds way better than being a cop. And so I researched and there's this like online, it basically exists so people can do weddings. I think it's called the Church of, I don't remember what it's called now, but anyway,
there's a Universal Life Church.
That's the one. Yes. Universal Life. And, you know, and you basically just fill out your personal information and they mail you a certificate, you know, and like, I think like a thing you can put on your car that says clergy or something, you know? And so that made me a minister or whatever, you know, I was ordained and I could officiate weddings now. And so we do the wedding and like when I'm out and so during the service, you know, I'm up there in my suit. I'm officiating these two young people getting married. Like something that hit me like, this is something you need to do. Like, it almost felt like I was being commanded. You know, like, there weren't words, but it was like, this is your path. You need to, and it wasn't even like get ordained. It was more like, I don't know what it was, but it just like, you need to get ordained or not ordained, but I don't even know how I articulated it back then, but I guess the gist of it was to share the Dharma, you know, it was like that was the flavor of it, you know? And I remember, I don't know if you remember this, but you'd been ordained and I'm like, can you ordain me? And you said, no. And I'm like, well, maybe Millwood. He's like, he's going to want you to go to Tassajara. I'm like, well, I'm married and have kids. And you're like, well, you could ask him, you know, which I don't think I ever did. And then, so I thought like, oh, I guess, and I didn't know any other priests. So I'm like, oh, I guess this is just not going to happen. And then like, you know, like a lot of people, I'm on this Facebook, you know, Soto Zen Facebook group and all the Facebook groups. And there's this guy named John, and he said something like, kind of harsh to someone a little bit, you know, like he had a good point actually, you know, but I thought it was maybe a little indelicate the way he did it. I'm like, who is this guy? You know? And I looked at his profile and, in a priest, Soto Zen priest, I don't know if it even said Soto, but like, so, you know, Zen priest. And I looked where he lived and he, you know, as a crow flies, he maybe lived like 4 miles from me or something. I'm like, oh, and, I looked into it and it, and so it's the Clear Mind Zen, and it's kind of so Matsuoka Roshi. He was actually in America before Suzuki Roshi, and actually, I think was part of like bringing Suzuki Roshi to America. And so he was like a really early Zen pioneer, but he never created a big center. So like a lot of people don't know about him. And also, he was really into like lay practice, and so he was into like his students basically living lay lives. So it kind of flew under the radar a little bit. I'd never even heard of him prior to like researching John's history. And I thought like, oh, well, you know, I was like, I've never heard of this lineage. And I'm like, I texted John and we ended up meeting. And it was just one of those things, you know, like you go on a date and you just have chemistry. And you're like, oh, you know, like maybe the first time you met Karen, you know, there's this chemistry there, right? You know? Right. Or maybe it developed, but at one point there was chemistry and there's just chemistry between us. I don't know how to explain it. And, but you know, my, I wasn't really looking for like a teacher. I was just looking like someone who, I guess one thing that I should say is like, ever since that experience at the wedding, like I felt like it was like a weight lifted on, like a weight pressing on me, like you got to do this, you know? And I just, like, I didn't want to, you know, I was happy just being a Zazen practitioner, you know. But so my main motivation was working with John was to get, you know, get ordained, you know, and I thought, like, and we have great chemistry, but just fortuitously, he ended up being a wonderful teacher for me. And, you know, and he's like, very, you know, he hates ritual, you know, I don't know if hates, but he doesn't value ritual at all. And so he was not what I would traditionally look for in a teacher, you know, and he's very casual and kind of profane and like, but you know, he's also, you know, he'd be upset. I hope he doesn't hear this. He'd be upset to hear, but he's like maybe the sweetest guy I've ever met in my life. Just like, just so much love and is in caring and he also has this like no nonsense. I don't suffer food gladly, that he just wouldn't allow me to have my bullshit. You know, he just like, no, I don't even know how to explain it, but he just cut through everything. And I think part of it, once we really got serious into our practice and like the formal priest training, that's when COVID hit, you know, right when like, it was between like just John's like cut the bullshit away and COVID, it was like I was in a furnace. And one thing I really liked about John, and that whole lineage was, it was very clear up to that point, I was practicing for myself, you know? Maybe with the exception is, it was clear that practice made me less of a jerk to those in my immediate vicinity, you know? But still, it was like still a very self-referential reason for practicing. Whereas John is all about what service can you do for other people? And like that, and I don't even know if he ever said those words, but that's just the way he lived his life, you know? And you know, like you, I don't think he's ever taken a cent to be a teacher. And in fact, I'm sure it costs him money, you know, and so it just completely swapped my perspective on practice, where it wasn't something I was doing it for myself. You know, part of the formal curriculum is like, what service projects can you do for other people? And ironically, once I was no longer worried about my own practice and cared about other people's, my own life got way easier. You know, it's like it's, you know, and this brings me back to like after that experience I had with Diane Rossetto, I happened to be reading a Dogen, what's his name?
Give me a hint.
He was a reviver of Red Zazen in Japan. Hakuin, sorry.
Oh, Hakuin, yeah.
I was reading his autobiography, and he said, you know, and so he had all these like amazing Kensho experiences, but he was disappointed that his daily life wasn't improving, you know, like he wasn't owning these. And he says, I figured out the secret, you know, how to resolve this dichotomy between this, you know, brilliant heights I was awakened to, yet still the messiness of my daily life. And I'm like, yes, tell me the answer. I really need to hear this. And he says, it's to save all beings and bodhicitta. I was like, what? That's bullshit. You know, like I wanted to hear like, oh, you have to do these koans and, you know, go to the, you know, have this experience. You know, I was really disappointed that the answer was basically service to others, you know. And as it turned out, you know, my own, I guess, peace in my heart is very much correlated to helping others.
Yeah.
Almost a one-to-one correlation, you know. And 10 years ago, I can't say I definitely was better off for having practices, but I can't say I was at peace. Whereas now I still have my issues, but I can say I'm largely at peace, and it's definitely tracked with helping other people and wanting to help other people, you know?
You know, that
fascinating journey. What's that?
It brings me to a question I was going to bring up, or actually something I wanted you to speak about, which was, you told me, you know, one of the things you do is you're a river guide. And within that, you take disabled people down the river as a service. And you told me a story about taking an autistic fellow down the river. Mm-hmm. And I'd like you to tell that story, because I just think it was I think it was what you're talking about right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was around the same time, too. It was all the same kind of movement. And so this was a trip for people with pretty significant autism. And so the organization is called ETC, Environmental Traveling Companions, and they're a nonprofit rafting company. And what they do is what they do to pay the bills is they take a lot of like high school and junior high kids down the river. You know, those kind of just feel like your average everyday commercial rafting trip, you know. Mm-hmm. But a good half of their trips are taking groups of people that would normally never be able to do that, either because of economic disadvantage, background, born into poverty type of stuff, or disabilities. I've never been on trips, but there's a blind trip, there's a hemophiliac trip, I've been on trips where there's like paraplegics that are on, Well, anyway, so this trip was for autistics, and the way the setup was there's a guide rowing, and then like on the front bench of the rowing frame, kind of, there's this kid, he's maybe 17 or so, and then his mom to the right, and then him in the middle and me on the other side, and I'm just there where he does not go into the water, under any circumstance. Like this kind of guy, we call it swimming in the rafting worlds when someone, it's a kind of a euphemistic phrase for like falling out of the boat. And like this is one of those trips where there's just no swimmers, no matter what, That's my job. Just he's not, and God forbid if he's in the water, I'm in there with him, to manage the situation. And so I was there, and during the trip, he started like laughing and like, and just like coming out. Like when he first got there, he was like nonverbal, almost like he was in a comatose. He could walk. If you asked him to sit somewhere, he'd go sit there, but not connecting with people at all. Just staring straight ahead, or actually just kind of staring down. Just barely moving, like it's almost like the external world didn't exist for him unless you asked him to do something, But during the trip, he started laughing, and I think he clapped his hands type of thing. And at one point, he took my hands and looked in my eye and smiled. And his mom's like, oh, he's never done that before. And it was like really one of the most magical moments of my life. It was just incredible, And there's something about rafting that just can have that transformation. Like this last year, I work with this local organization called American River Conservancy, and what they do is they buy land to protect it, basically. And one of the lands they bought was the Wakamatsu Farm, which was the site of the first Japanese American colony in America, and they just protect it and have events there and everything. And I told you like, there's explicit service obligations for working in the Clear Mind Zen lineage. But right when I set up a sitting group, COVID hit. So I had to stop that. Because usually people start sitting groups or they work as chaplains. Those are generally the two main paths for service in Clear Mind Zen. But both of those were out of the picture because of COVID, out of the question because of COVID. So what I did instead was I started this outside silent meditation walking group at Wakamatsu through American River Conservancy. And then I eventually added sitting meditation and Qigong to it to make it more kind of well-rounded. But it was like something outside I could do to, kind of have a service project, Right. What I was working towards is, they're a nonprofit organization, and there was this one family that's a pretty big benefactor of donating money and stuff to the organization. And as a, kind of as a thank you to them, I took them down the river. Mm-hmm. What happened is, it was actually a raffle, And I donated a trip for six people down the river as the raffle. And at the last minute, one of the people from that family put their ticket in. And I think what happened was someone cheated and chose them manually from the raffle. I hope no one hears this, but like, they've just been, and I've since, at this point, I've said, I'm just going to take you guys every year, or it was just an amazing coincidence. But either way, I mean, I think they're the biggest donors to the organization of all time, you know? Yeah. Anyway, and as a thank you, you know, I took, and I just like completely, you know, wonderful lunch and all that kind of stuff. But after the trip, it went really well and everyone was happy. But after the trip, you know, the kind of main liaison from that family reached out to me and she said, you know, I'm not going to say who it was, but the way she described it was obvious who it was. You know, this person has been having really bad PSD and we can't tell you how appreciative we are of your trip because, you know, this is like the person who had PSD, like reported it was the first time in years that she felt free of her symptoms during this trip, you know, just like being in the moment. Cause there's something about whitewater rafting where it's exciting enough that you are not just thinking about yourself. But it's not so crazy that you think you're gonna die at every moment. You know what I mean? It really falls in this niche of where it's just perfectly situated to like get people out of their self-referential processing. And she said, you know, and the daughter was on the trip, and she says it was the first time the daughter had her mom back in years, and you know, and like you know, this seems like a turning point for her. And it just, I mean, it literally made me cry in like reading this email. It just shows how, you know, this kind of dynamic happens even outside of like a spiritual, explicitly spiritual or religious context. You know, it's something inherent to humans. You know, we just are really good at it.
Yeah. Well, you know, rafting, it brings you into the present moment, right? I mean, it's alive. I mean, the water's alive, you know, the wind's alive, everything in it's just an alive space.
Yeah. I found rock climbing does it too.
Yeah.
And they've done research on these kind of flow states. And what they found is if it's too easy or too hard, it doesn't open up a flow state. There has to be a happy medium.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's have the right kind of sashin, you know, not too easy, right. Not too hard, just the right number.
That first sashin with Rhett, that was with Rhett, by the way, that one.
Well, the early Zen Center sashins were
that was too hard. Hard. Plus, I wasn't prepared for it.
I did one, you know, and probably maybe a little earlier than you, and it was the hardest thing I ever did in my life that I'll ever do, because of course I didn't know what I was doing.
Right. I remember you talking about that.
Mind.
I remember when I heard you talk about that at a Dharma talk, I remember thinking, oh, I can relate to this at all. Like, weren't you like crying with someone holding you at the end or something?
Yeah. At the end. Yeah. I was down on the floor with my best friend holding me. I sobbed.
Yeah, it's intense.
Half joy and half, you know, I don't know what else, but that it was over. But just the release, you know, was pretty, pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's pretty much like up till the moment. Is there any other questions you had or?
You know, Barry, you just like hit all the things I wanted to talk about. You know, I don't think I've left anything out. You just told your story, and I'm really glad that we got to this community service piece. And I mean, if that's not explicitly a part of any Zen traditions practice, you know, it's necessary. It's necessary that. I mean, offering the practice itself is service, mm-hmm. and then you can extend that in so many different directions. And I really appreciate the way you have done with your service activities. And
thank you. Yeah, I mean, I really owe it all to John. I mean, I don't think it would even have crossed my mind. Well, maybe I don't know. There's something happened in that wedding that put me down that path for sure.
Yeah. But, well, yeah. I remember when you were wanting to be ordained and looking for a path that you could be sort of outside of the, you know, certain frameworks of that have been created to ensure that people, you know, have the right background, and there's reasons for that. You have, you know, what, 30 years of practice and that's a substantial resume of I think is serving you well.
Yeah. You know, it's weird though, but it really only started clicking maybe 6 or 7 years ago. You know, I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, I got all the normal benefits of practice, you know, less emotionally resilient. I mean, more emotionally resilient, you know, less, you know, reactivity, you know, but it really, I guess my point is I stuck with it for a long time before it really kind of paid off fully, or not fully, but yeah, the point is, if anyone's listening to this, like, stick with it. Stick with it, you know.
It's always
not linear. It's not like 10 years of practice gives you 10 years of Dharma points. You know, it's like, it can be a very non-linear progression, you know. But you know, that was one advantage of the those early Grateful Dead years, was I had the insights first before I even knew Buddhism really existed. Like, I thought Buddhism was like worshiping a statue, you know, like, you know, like monks, which, you know what I mean? I thought it was like putting fruit to a peanut, like to an elephant statue or something, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't know anything about Buddhism, but, you know, I had those experiences. I always had the faith, you know, because I had the verification kind of first. And then it was just a question of what's the best path to really kind of bring this into my life. So I never really, other than kind of those couple of years where I was kind of disillusioned from the opening, I always kind of had faith, you know what I mean? So that's kind of why I stuck with it. And I think looking back too, I think seeing like teachers, like seeing Diane and you guys and other people where, you know, clearly practices worked for them, you know, I think that also engenders some faith, you know, where you kind of have role models too. So I was willing to stick with it. And, you know, I recommend other people, even if it seems totally pointless, stick with it, you know?
Well, I think your story is actually demonstrates the path, as I understand it, sudden realization, gradual practice, and gradual practice never ends.
Yeah.
You know, there's always more rocks to be turned over.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I feel like I'm just getting started in a lot of ways, you know.
Right. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This was really good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird talking about yourself, but I've inflicted it on a lot of people. So I guess it's
right. Like, so right. Turnabout is fair play.
Right.
Well, thank you so much. It was very cogent, and I think it'll be enjoyed by people that listen to it.
Cool. Well, thank you so much.